More than 25 years ago, a genocide in Rwanda killed nearly a million people in a matter of 100 days. The international community did not see it coming, and its response was catastrophic. It ended up helping war criminals more than their victims. That genocide exposed the lack of quality information about crisis response, and in its wake, a UN project called IRINews was born. The thinking was, had there been a better flow of information, responders could have saved more lives. 20 years later, IRINews spun off from the UN to become independent and changed its name to the New Humanitarian. And to mark a quarter century of reporting from the heart of crises, last year we launched our Rethinking Humanitarianism series and this podcast. Humanitarianism has changed a lot in that time. Media coverage of crises has changed too, and one man has been along for most of that journey as both a journalist and an aid worker. Today, he shares with us his reflections on years of reporting on humanitarian crises and the aid industry. This is Rethinking Humanitarianism. I'm your host, Hiba Ali. Today, we have a special bonus episode for you, and it comes as something of a sad moment for me personally and for the New Humanitarian. We are saying goodbye to our co-founder, our former CEO, and most recently, our senior policy editor, Ben Parker, after more than 25 years on and off with the organization. Ben was the first person to smuggle video of the genocide in Darfur out of the country. He oversaw the coordination of aid in Syria at the start of the war. And as a journalist at IRIN and the New Humanitarian, he exposed fraud, misconduct, sexual abuse, and incompetence within aid agencies. I know I'm biased, but I think there is no doubt that he is one of the most astute observers of the humanitarian sector and a tough critic. And yet, believe it or not, Ben is leaving the New Humanitarian for a senior role at the UN. Today, I am sitting down with Ben to look back on his work over the years, and we'll cover a range of issues from the impact of reporting a genocide to governments calling the bluff of the international community to why aid agencies need to focus on freedom of information. Ben, welcome to the Rethinking Humanitarianism podcast.
Thank you very much.
And I should note to listeners that Ben and I have known each other for a long time. We have worked very closely together for many years. So this is going to be a somewhat different kind of conversation with a dear friend recorded from my living room in Geneva over a glass of wine. Let's start from the beginning, shall we? You were a co-founder of IRINews back in 1995. What were you doing at the time, and why did you think it was necessary to start a media outlet focused on humanitarian crises?
I was working for the World Food Programme in Nairobi. The goal was to keep track of where all the food aid was floating around East Africa, and there was a lot at the time. My name was brought to somebody who was thinking up this new thing. They said, this guy might be useful for you. I was fairly young and eager and inexperienced, but this new project sounded good.
You were tasked with getting this project off the ground. You had $500,000 at the beginning, if I understand correctly.
We made a sort of gateway where you could send an email and it would spew out a fax. So if you were the, I don't know, embassy of Rwanda or Germany or whoever, you might have a fax number, you might not have an email, and our system could deliver equally to you.
In 1996, a Christian youth leader from South Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo walks into your office in Nairobi. And what happens?
So at the beginning, it would be wrong to say that it was a journalistic concept. It was more of a kind of clearing house. I think that was our phrase that we liked, a clearing house of information and sit reps. And, you know, there were a number of relevant information sources who were pushing stuff out by email. To be honest, we were just running a kind of a forwarding mailing list. So when Sebi walked into the office, for me at least, it was the end of one chapter and the beginning of another, in the sense that original reporting then became like a very visible and compelling prospect. He came in. He described the difficulties in South Kivu with the ethnic minority who were being dispossessed by the majority and the ruling party, and a pattern which of course still informs Eastern Congo to this day. We crossed the line from being a kind of aid sit rep distributor to being journalism around that time.
And that was the content that ultimately became some of the first descriptions of the civil war in DRC.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the first Congo War. There was definitely an opportunity to write about tricky, complex, underreported conflict dynamics with a humanitarian impact, and it wasn't being done by others.
So what was it like reporting about conflict and crisis in the 1990s, like the politics of it, the practicalities of it?
We started in East Africa, and we started in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. In East Africa, we have a significant number of major crises there. You have international rivalries between the states in the region and a lot of foreign interference and alliances as well. The opportunity which kind of presented itself was, first of all, to write original material, but also not to editorialize so much as to synthesize. So I think our first efforts were really like a weekly report, which picked the best of the week for readers. Is still something that the New Humanitarian does today. That sort of digesting thing is a product which I think most news organizations would agree is popular. What was exciting was to say, actually, this is news, this is reporting, this is research, this is somewhere between, I don't know, crisis group and Reuters, and somewhere in between. And we did feel that we were sort of feeling out a new genre.
Then the next decade brought the conflict in Darfur, the tsunami in Indonesia, the earthquake in Haiti, the rise of Boko Haram. And here you are with this new genre of reporting. What was that like? And I suppose what characterized that era of humanitarianism?
We expanded relatively cautiously, I think, into the rest of sub-Saharan Africa over those years. We also started quite early into Central Asia, which is a still a neglected region. I think the geographical expansion was basically Africa and then kind of where next. We had this model of having a little tiny bureau and a couple of people there full time. We always relied to some extent on stringers, but the backbone of the product was largely desk reporting with occasional sort of field trips. And I don't think we came up with a particularly clever journalism model. I just think we picked a topic that there was a wide open field.
But when you look at the humanitarian response or humanitarianism, if that's an appropriate word to use, comparing to the age of Rwanda and the 1990s, how were the crises of the 2000s different and the way that the world responded to them different?
I think Darfur was one of those ones where I certainly thought there would be a point at which a line would be crossed and international kind of alarm would be so high that there would be a step change in the way it was being dealt with. Mm. I remember I was working in Darfur, I think at
that
time.
Sorry, but because of Rwanda, that people wouldn't tolerate that anymore.
For me, the arc really starts a little bit earlier. The arc starts in Mogadishu with Black Hawk Down. The catastrophic American intervention in Somalia, which did really nothing for Somalis and put Americans off excursions like it for many years, although didn't put them off permanently. But humanitarian excursions, I think it did have a chilling effect. And so when Rwanda came 2 years after Black Hawk Down, there was no appetite to go in. Mm. And it's debatable, of course, whether going in, quote unquote, would have helped. So the arc was more about engagement, not engagement, neglect or not neglect. So Sri Lanka, the end of the Sri Lankan Civil War, there was a very heavy level of human rights abuse in the pursuit of counterinsurgency. I think that reverberation is also part of the arc, the way I see it. That assertive states, strong military states, can say, I dare you. I dare you. Stop me. Stop me if you can. And we see that today in a number of different countries. And
more so.
Calling the bluff of the so-called international community is working.
More so than before?
Certainly more so than the early 90s. Kosovo and NATO, kind of a special case. And I think altogether, we found that there was one theme in humanitarian journalism, which was like neglect. Oh, it's forgotten. You're forgetting. You should care. You know, we're here to remind you these people are over there and they need. And I think that has a very problematic level of diminishing returns. It's like, you must care. No, no, you really should care. No, no, no. It's whataboutism, but with a kind of moral shawl around it. And I don't think that's very productive, but I think it is a noble effort to remind people of all the bits and pieces of the world that aren't very important to the powers that be. And I think that's a legitimate theme to our journalism. So
what's the alternative to the you should care?
What's the alternative to you should care? The alternative to you should care is like, look at this now on its merits. So rather than a kind of guilt trip, it should be a trip through the lives of people who are affected, a trip that perhaps compares compellingly your life to theirs, your privilege to their
misfortune. And what if misfortune? No one cares?
If no one cares, then no one cares. It's not the journalist's fault.
Yeah, but it does put us in a very difficult situation in terms of understanding where our value add is.
If you cannot make life and death interesting, then you should probably not be a journalist.
So let's turn to some of your stories, both, I suppose, as a journalist and as an aid worker, because aid workers are storytellers in their own right to some degree. You were the first person to smuggle tape of the genocide in Darfur out of Sudan and into the mainstream news. Who were you working for then, and how did you do that?
I was working for the UN then. I was working for the UN. And funnily enough, I was on a trip with an Iran reporter. I was a communication person for the UN. Looking back, it was disappointing.
What was?
The limited impact we had. We had footage. I thought, you know, I was a comms person. I knew you need video, right? You need video if you want a breakthrough. And we had stills and we had compelling first-person accounts. Children were being recruited. There were babies burned by chemical incendiary bombs. There was huge numbers of displaced. There was definitely a flavor of ethnic cleansing, and which was later to be defined as genocide. And I actually came to Geneva and I put this together, this PowerPoint. And I thought, and I what they call a member state briefing. It's like, you get to talk to whoever volunteers to show up. So UNICEF had laid on this thing. And I gave this talk and I showed these pictures of literally babies with burns. I would argue it wasn't exploitative. It was responsible visuals to make a case about the severity of the conflict. It was 2 weeks before Christmas. We didn't have like good guys and bad guys. We didn't have a kind of call to action. And it didn't, it just kind of sank. It was one of my most disappointing experiences, actually. And we got a lot. We got detained a tiny bit. We got slightly delayed by a couple of, you know, officials. And we did our work, you know, and but the packaging and the delivery and the timing, and there's so many ways that a story doesn't land. And whether you're a comms person or a journalist, that's where I think the two worlds are quite close. I wasn't trying to hoodwink journalists into writing a nice story about UNICEF. It was absolutely not. I was like bringing them raw material, and it didn't quite take off. Or at least it didn't take off in the way I would have hoped. In the end, Darfur, of course, became a kind of cause célèbre.
What does that force us to reflect on in terms of what this whole endeavor of reporting on crises is about and whether
I think raising the alarm is only one of the roles of the New Humanitarian and others like it. Raising the alarm, which is like claiming or at least the ambition to kind of break through the noise and the blah and the fatigue and the racist disinterest and get a story out there, because it is a big thing, what's happening to actual people. That's only one of your roles. And I don't think kind of cracking through that ceiling should be the...
be all and end all.
Yeah, it shouldn't be your metric.
But is it a lost cause? Trying to report on these issues, trying to make people care about these issues.
No, because they thank goodness, they do break through. But for the most weirdest of stupidest of reasons. Mm. The baby on the beach in Turkey can change the entire story. It's one photo. I think it's a matter of persistence. Yeah. And that you have a body of work that says, you guys may not really feel that strongly about Burundi, but we're going to keep on, we're going to keep on plowing. We're going to keep on planting a few seeds.
Until one day something works.
One day you're going to need that stuff, because that's how time and history works, because something will happen in Burundi and you'll be like, oh my God, okay, now I need to figure out about Burundi. Gaming the attention economy cannot be a strategy.
Let's go back to Darfur. So for a moment it was in the spotlight and then it disappeared. And we just published a series recently about continued violence in Darfur. Nobody cares. Nobody's paying any attention. So seeing the media kind of dip in and out of these stories, how much does media coverage really change the...
I think that's your painful job as the chief of the operation, is to say, when do I do Burundi? Because nobody's talking about Burundi. And when do I do Afghanistan? Because everybody's talking about Afghanistan. And I think there's always been that tension. I think we've discussed it many times internally. And a bit of both is the answer.
I like to believe that the many years of covering Burundi when nobody cares helps catalyze that coverage when it eventually appears. And that body of work is slow and steady and unremarkable in some ways, but that ultimately the big breakthrough stories can't exist without it.
We hear a lot of journalists and aid workers and diplomats and conflict analysts and think tankers. They're going to country X. What do they print out to read on the plane?
Yeah.
This kind of cautious, sensible, deep, thorough, thoughtful journalism that you don't have time for.
You say cautious as though it's a negative thing.
I wasn't sure about the word cautious. I think cautious because not jumping to the easy storyline.
Yeah.
Not framing it in the cheap way. Mm. You know, tribe versus tribe. You know, evil dictator versus heroic civil society. You know, these framings, these tropes. And we've invited people into our boudoir, as it were, to listen to our conversations about this. And it's difficult stuff. But to me, cautious to me is not lazy. Mm. I think the cautious to me in this context is the opposite of lazy.
Tell me about some of the stories you've been most proud of over the years.
I'm proudest of the stories that broke new ground and nudged people to think afresh about topics that were a bit sort of borderline. I'm proud of the coverage we've done on technology and data protection and the lack of it. And we, at the New Humanitarian, if we do it right, we increase the cost of bad behavior.
Mm. That's right.
And I'm proud of that.
That's right.
So that people think, oh my God, what if they get hold of this?
Yeah.
Someone sent me something today. Their friend had said to them, oh my God, is the New Humanitarian on top of this thing?
Mm.
Because they want people who are in the industry, and I'm happy to call it industry, they actually like the fact that there's a watchdog.
Yeah.
And I'm proud that there are people of goodwill who want, you know, the right news to get out.
Someone told me once, we fight for things within our organizations all the time, and it's only when you guys report on it that our CEO pays attention.
It's so, I mean, it's so depressing. Is the humanitarian sector uniquely dysfunctional in terms of its reportage and accountability? And my feeling is yes, that the incentives are so warped and there aren't the normal measures of either profit, if you're in a commercial sector, or customer feedback, if you're in a commercial slash democratic context. So if the refugee in Eastern Sudan is getting a raw deal and the donor is in, let's say, Paris, and the implementer is in Geneva,
yeah,
the incentives aren't there. Checks and balances aren't there. And so that's why I've continued to believe that independent journalism is a missing link in the conversations about how aid doesn't really reflect what people need. It is tends to be run on a sort of do what we say kind of basis. And that's where I really wish there were more actually working on this as well as the new humanitarian, because a little bit of chill in the backbone that somebody's going to actually look over your shoulder and read your stupid email and your crappy project implementation, it's motivating.
We will be looking over your shoulder very soon.
Yes. Yes, my shoulder is my shoulder is highly confidential. Yes, don't touch my shoulder.
So your reporting in recent years has focused very much on the practice and policy of humanitarian aid. And I'd love to just hear a bit of your reflections on how, like, what has been the biggest change in the humanitarian sector since you began this work?
One is the use of cash instead of giving people stuff, give them money. Another is a better technical approach to hungry children, in terms of not medicalizing their treatment so much. But probably the biggest change, and it's crept up on me, is the size of the budgets.
Mm.
So somebody was saying to me, oh, yeah, it's WFP is X billion. I was like, really? I should know this stuff, right? Mm. But, you know, several billion a year. The growth, yeah, I think the size of it, the volumes of money are significantly different. The technocratic kind of superstructure is ever growing, and the fundamentals haven't changed very much.
Mm.
So well meaning, allegedly, internationals bringing good stuff to people, others, you know, and the coloniality, the paternalism, and the kind of racism that might clearly imply are more visible now, but the structurally, it's kind of the same. Those with resources have an obligation, I think, a moral obligation in any cultural value system, to help those who are less fortunate. But somehow this has become kind of a kind of apparatus of judgment and value and systematic kind of paternalistic behavior that I think needs to feel the brakes.
So this is a podcast about rethinking humanitarianism. How are you rethinking the sector after all these years of covering it? When you take a step back, what is it for you that is the major rethink compared to 30 years ago when you first entered into this space?
I think it's very healthy that there's a renewed focus on power dynamics, post-colonialism.
No, what I mean is, how are you, Ben Parker, thinking differently about this thing that you have committed your entire career to? Does it still make sense to you?
I want to remain in it. I want it to be better. I want less stupidity. I want less lying and venality and waste and hypocrisy. And it's massively naive and banal at one level, but on the other hand, it's the only moral position to take. So I've recently decided to cross the kind of fence from poacher to be gamekeeper, because I want to be in the room. I want to be in the room rather than listening, eavesdropping on the room from the outside as a journalist saying, what did they say? What did they say? I want to be in the room and I want to hear what they say. And I want to maybe get the opportunity to drop a word in ears here and there. Increasingly, I think better behavior by individual people and individual organizations matters more and more. And I think integrity is probably my watchword, and I want to know that those who do have influence are kind of deploying it for the right reasons, and that they're not motivated unhealthily. So yeah, I want to go back in the room and say, have you thought of that? Have you tried that? Do you think really that you've covered that? I'm going to be annoying in a different way.
A lot of people will say, you know, you have exposed massive hacks of the UN, you have exposed poor data protection, you have exposed, you know, the competition between UN agencies, the multi-million dollar frauds. You have been a critic of the system, and now you're walking right into it.
And I'll remain critical. I think it's fine to know what you're talking about and try and influence it from a different vantage point. Yeah, I can prod and poke and kind of harass a formal body from the outside. But also I can constructively work inside that body. And yeah, maybe they'll drive me mad and I won't be able to tolerate it, but I'm not an absolutist. I'm not a black and white person. We're in the gray. I worked in Syria. I was the head of the UN relief in Syria. And obviously, my colleagues outside, that all the people in Damascus had like Stockholm syndrome. And it's like, no, you come and negotiate with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Syrian Arab Republic, and you tell me what you could have extracted that I didn't extract. So that, yeah, maybe there's a certain amount of self-regard in that statement, but I think influence and influencing can happen in many, from many different, you know, vantage points. And I'm also happy for myself to have another crack at these problems from a different angle.
Having seen it from both the inside and the outside, so understanding how difficult it is to negotiate when you're on the inside, but seeing the very obvious critiques when you're on the outside, what will your message be in your new role? How are you going to, what do you take with you into that role in terms of what your North Star is?
I think there are maybe two major themes that we will be addressing. One is conflicts in which the respect for old-fashioned humanitarian law and values are almost evaporating. Right? So the idea that you help your enemy's civilians while fighting your enemy's soldiers, that is looking very fragile, and I think it needs attention. And I think the other area we will be dealing with is mega disasters fueled by climate change and compounded by overlapping supplementary crises, like you have a power cut and then you have a tsunami, and then you have a riot, and then you have a financial crisis. You know, these kind of multiverse of disasters, I think, is going to be, that will be part of our future. And it includes, you know, future diseases. We've had a strong warning from COVID, but I think there are others.
Before I let you go, there is a question we ask all of our guests, as you know. What are simple, practical ways of improving the way the world responds to crises that could be implemented today and that you will be ready to push forward in your new role?
Freedom of information.
Is that serious?
Yes. Hmm. Yeah, I think we have the system that I described where the incentives are not really there for good behavior. So if you're in banking, you have a regulator, you have customers, you have the financial media, you have all sorts of people who are going to be watching you, catching you out when you fail. And those kind of fairly normal mechanisms of control or moderation are not really there in the humanitarian sector because, A, there isn't really a free press that can make any money out of it, hence the need for things like the new humanitarian. B, the customer is not the king. Mm-hmm. The customer is the bottom of the pile, because if you're a refugee in Eastern Sudan and you're getting a raw deal, who do you go to? And the donors who pay for most of this stuff, which is basically Western, Northern taxpayers, they want to do the right thing, but they also don't want to hear of bad news, because then the papers and the other politics will come and denigrate the whole venture. My big idea is this is an industry which is opaque, it has unhealthy incentives, it has cronyism and a level of complacency that is exceptionally unhealthy. I think opening the books to the public would be the best way to enhance transparency and quality across the whole board. That means NGOs should publish much more detail about what they do. Mm. The refugee in Eastern Sudan should be able to ask, what is the salary of the person who was just extremely rude to me? Mm. The taxpayer in Oslo should also be able to know what happened with my money when it went to Eastern Sudan. So yeah, freedom of information.
We are going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you too.
You're going to regret the day you ever met me, holding you accountable for everything you've just said.
I would expect nothing less.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this bonus episode. But you can check out Ben's work on aid policy on our website, thenewhumanitarian.org/authors/Ben-Parker. And you'll also find a goodbye piece he's just written with his reflections on humanitarian reporting. We'll also be sharing some of his best stories on Twitter, so look out for that. We will be back with our usual episodes of Rethinking Humanitarianism on Wednesday. We're going to be looking into progress made in the humanitarian aid sector towards greater diversity, equity, and inclusion, including the findings of a new survey by the New Humanitarian of aid agencies and aid workers on this topic. This podcast is a production of the New Humanitarian. This episode was edited by Marta Vanderwolf, and I'm your host, Hiba Ali. Today, we'll leave you with a few thoughts from members of our team at the New Humanitarian about our former colleague. Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of Rethinking Humanitarianism.
What I'll miss about Ben is his finger on the pulse for sure, his expert eye over all the trickier stories.
I hope that he remembers that he'll always be a journalist at heart, and he has a lot of work to do when it comes to cleaning up the UN.
I think it's fair to say that Ben is one of the best minds in the humanitarian aid sector, and while we may be resilient, I don't think we can replace that.
Through your work, you've opened minds and changed thinking around so many issues, from the importance of data protection to the language and so much of the fine print of communiques and other documents that are in fact matters of life and death for so many.